On this episode of Interview in Indies, we talk to Zark Attack, the creator of Exophobia. We discuss game jams, gaming conventions, and even the struggles of being a solo developer on a Metroidvania game. If you want to support the show or get the show early, you can subscribe on Patreon. And of course, enjoy the show. Hello, welcome to Interview in Indies Episode 4. I'm the host, Burr, and today we're joined by the developer of Exophobia, Zark Attack. Thanks for joining, Zark.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Well, we can just jump straight into it. My first question for everybody always is, when did you get into development, like favorite games growing up, all that kind of stuff? What led you to the path that you're on now?
Yeah, so when I was a kid, I didn't have any consoles. I didn't grow up with any consoles at all. But one day, my parents offered me a Game Boy Color, which is my first console ever. I only played with my friends and all that on Mega Drive, which is a Genesis, I think. Played in other people's homes. And I was at this dream of like, wait, what if I could make like these worlds by myself? And I started drawing levels for Sonic and stuff like that, like just imagining what it would look like. And then one day when I was in middle school, I discovered I just searched like how to make games. And the first thing that came up was Game Maker, the engine. And at the time, I didn't know anything about what was coding, what was making games. I didn't know anything about that. But I played a lot of, besides my console, which is Game Boy Color, which I loved, I also played a lot of web games in Flash and all that. And so I was kind of familiarized with the indie scene, right?
Yeah.
It's when someone like just came up with an idea and made something and put it online. So it kind of inspired me like, okay, with Game Maker, I can also do that. And then I started joining their forums and all that. And I put together simple games, platformers with the tutorials, started learning. It evolved a bit like that. So I started very early.
So in middle school. You're basically like kind of self-taught. You kind of taught yourself how to do everything. That's kind of impressive.
Because I really wanted to play something.
I had ideas else.
And I wanted to make them happen.
Well, I was looking back at a lot of your past work, and I noticed in your very early days, years ago, you had a lot of things called game jams. You participated in a lot of those. And for, I guess, people that may be unaware, can you explain what a game jam is and then maybe some of your best memories or favorite games you've made during them?
So a game jam is when you challenge yourself to create a game under a certain time restriction, right? So it's usually like a weekend or something that you can say that you started and finished a video game in one weekend. So the best example I have for that was the first one I participated, which is Ludum Dare, which has two sections. You can participate as a solo dev or as a team. And as a solo dev, you have to make all the assets, like everything, the art, the music, the programming. And then in a weekend, you start and finish a game, and then you don't touch it. So people will play it and give it a rating. So it's nice because it's like you have this weekend and you can put one idea you have in your head out there and just make it, which is really nice. But game jams can be like have any kind of teams. Can happen in weekends or weeks, months. But it's a really cool way to just get in there and just make a game. And you kind of have to crunch a bit to make something, but it doesn't have to be perfect. Just has to show what your idea is. So I really love doing game jams because when I was learning, it's a great way to learn to make games because you can get your mistakes out there really fast. Your designer brain, you can just act on it and then find out what works, what doesn't work. And I use game jams to like test a lot of genres. So that's also how Exophobia was born, because I was like testing, what if I do a platformer? What if I do a Metroidvania? What if I do like a puzzle game? So each game jam, I was trying like to challenge myself to do different genres and different styles and trying to learn along the way. And Exophobia was born out of that because I wanted to try to, what if I made like a first person shooter at the time?
Yeah.
And I never had made a 3D game before. And it was born out of a game jam like that. Yeah. And I really like doing game jams solo But my best memories are from doing with the teams. You also have, like, instead of just doing online like Ludumdare is, you can join with the team physically. There are physical game jams that you can also participate and, like, go to a big, like, a school or something where there are dozens of teams, and then you can work together and try to, like, talk with other devs and learn from them. And those are the best memories. It's just, and you can make the team on the spot. Like, you go to the place and then you meet other developers.
Just, you meet a bunch of people and just start making a game immediately. Now, do you still
you eat a lot of pizza?
Yeah, you eat a lot of pizza.
There's a lot of pizza involved. Yes, and coffee.
Oh yeah, I imagine. And then, you still do this, and then though, just spend the weekend to this day.
Not much. I did some when I was working on Exophobia, but more rarely.
Okay.
Before that, I did a lot because it's nice. But in Portugal, there are some of those. Mostly when it's like big ones like Global Game Jam and all that. But yeah, I really like doing them. It's really fun.
It sounds like a fun time to really test your skills. And I was looking at some of your past work. I played a little bit. You had a lot of them. I guess I could ask about this one first, because it was the first game I saw on something called Game Jolt. You had a game called Deadline, and in the description you said you were experiencing some short deadlines yourself. Did the irony of life help you come up with this idea, or did you have the idea beforehand?
So the Game Jam team was like a horror team kind of team. You have to make like a horror game. And at the time I was crunching for college, like doing all these studies for exams and all that. And then like what is more horrifying than having like these short deadlines that you have to meet, like, and you have to study. And there's like exam after exam. And that idea came from that for that game. And then I like used like, it's time management game where you have to study for each test, and then you get a score based on the test. Yeah.
that was a good one. It looked interesting. One of them I did get to play was one called Kid Versus School. Mm-hmm. That one says you got second place in that game jam. Are there actually like big rewards for getting a high placement, or is it just all for fun, I imagine, right?
Yeah. So mostly are just for fun, but Ludendare has become like something really, like, if you place well enough, it's like get a lot of visibility. So a lot of devs have been trying to like, if I do a game and it does well there, then I'll pick up that game and work on it for full time or something, and then just put it out there on Steam. But that one, Kid Versus School, was one of my favorites because I worked on it with the sound designer and all that at home. And it was for a game jam that was hosted by PewDiePie.
Oh.
And then, yeah. And then it was really nice because I wasn't expecting it at all, that like just me. Like, there were a lot of big teams coming in. Like, oh, PewDiePie is going to play our game. And then everyone was participating in that one.
Yeah.
And then I got second place. I was not expecting that at all.
Oh, what was the prize?
And the prize was to be played by PewDiePie on his channel.
Did you get to see his reaction of the game? Because it was a very interesting game, to say the least.
And everyone was like doing a kind of YouTuber game, right? One of this like shocking and weird stuff. That's why I made the kid, like the game is about a kid that spills milk out of his nose.
I was very bad at it. Yeah.
And then PewDiePie played it, and it was like a really good highlight of my game jam career.
That must be a very good highlight. I did look at a few more game jams. There was one called Abyss of Failure. That looked like your first kind of shooter game. Was that early inspiration for what would become Exophobia?
Yeah, that one was like for another game jam of the same time that YouTubers would play it if it placed well enough. But I was more in like a mood of doing something more less silly and more serious. And that was like was kind of a shooting game platformer. It didn't evolve to be Exophobia, but I really liked to explore like games that are very tight. You know, like the action is very tight and there's a lot of action going on. That one was I really like that game, and now it came out on a polished kind of level. It's about like you have to go get a high score by climbing the tower with random generated levels, It was a really nice attempt at something like that at the time, yeah, for me.
It's impressive how many of these games you've made in such a short amount of time, because the list honestly goes on.
Oh, yeah. Well, these have been like 4 years, right?
So yeah, you've been doing
like, like 6 or 8 years just doing years. Like a game, not almost every month, but almost every month, right?
It's insane. Now, this next one, I'm pretty sure this is probably what turned into Exophobia based off the graphics and the gameplay.
Oh, yeah.
But The Red Planet, you want to walk us through that game? Is that the original Exophobia?
Yeah, that is our original Exophobia. Like, it looks very similar to what it came out to be today. At the time, like, one of the things that you have to do at the game jam is try to make your game as eye-catching as possible, I think, so people will want to play it. And since you have a limited time to make the game, like I had a weekend, I kind of went with that limited color palette, and it kind of worked really well. I think it worked really well for me. So it was like, what if I tried to do like a retro FPS? And then I had like Game Maker can make 3D games. I didn't know how to do it, but I had to learn it on the on the weekend.
Learned on the spot.
Yeah, I learned on the spot. And then, yeah, I made something I was really proud of, but the game was super unplayable because there was no time to test it properly. And when I submitted it, it was impossible to finish because there was like a door that needed a key, and I didn't put any key before that. And people were complaining that they couldn't finish the game.
The key was added later on because I got through the first door playing through it.
Yeah. Yeah, but the game, did you play it?
I played it a little bit. I couldn't get past the second enemy because they shot me so fast, and I moved so slow. I don't know if I had to do anything else to move faster, but it was definitely the early signs of Exophobia. Did you immediately start Exophobia after The Red Planet, or did you put it on the shelf for a little bit?
Yeah, I was done with it after the game jam. But then it got such a good reception, mostly because of the graphic style, because the gameplay was really hard and frustrating. And then I picked it up like 2-3 years later, and that's when I really started the development for it. After I finished college, it was basically, I want to try game dev for real this time. And instead of just doing game jams, I want to focus on one big project, and that was Exophobia. So I changed the name of the game. I trashed the code from the game jam and started something new. And then I tried to like to make something different. Like this first attempt was like just level for level. And how can I make this like a FPS that can be unique? And I added the Metroidvania element to it, made it tighter, controls are tighter. Tried to improve it in several ways to be a viable commercial title.
How hard was it to make it into a Metroidvania game as like your first major project, we could say?
Yes. Yeah, it was a mistake to go that way.
It was a mistake to go Metroidvania? Was...
No, I'm really proud of how it came out, but it took a lot of work to make it work, I think, yeah. Because the way you have to think to design a map like that, it's already hard in side-scroll, but... In first person, it kind of, I think it's still hard, but yeah, it took a lot of tries to make it work. And there's still, when I launched the game, there was still like people doing sequence breaks and all that and getting lost.
You can never stop those speedrunners.
Yeah.
I will say that it's a very good game. It's very well made for a first project. Yeah. I did get lost. Do you feel like, if you played Exophobia, which... I don't know how many people have. I would say it's one of those underrated games, but it is extremely vague on what you're supposed to do. Do you feel like it was extremely vague when you've made it, or you felt the difficulty was just fine?
Yeah, like the combat difficulty, I think it's fine, right? But the way that I try to guide the player, I wanted to make to give like really vague tips and all that, but I also wanted to not be like, oh, you know you have to go there, so you don't have any incentive to explore further, right? Like, if you know you have to go there, you're not going to explore the other rooms, and then you're not going to get that reward that when you go back to a room that you have been and you recognize that, and now you can progress, I think that's a really big part of the game, is that you need to find dead ends for you to feel good when you can overcome those dead ends after a while, after you get the upgrades and all that. So I really wanted to be vague in that sense, that it feels good to get stuck and then find progress, instead of just being a constant like, oh, here's one thing and here's one new thing, here's another new thing, here's another new thing. Yeah, if it could be better done, yeah, maybe it can. But at the time, I didn't have a lot of people to test it and see if they would find the correct way really fast. So now when I was watching streamers after the game was launched, I was like, it hurts a bit to see like everyone lost, and I try to help as much as I can, but like I can't be everywhere, right?
Oh yeah, most definitely.
With all the players, so. I think it makes part of the experience.
Oh, it definitely. I think it enhances the experience a lot, because mm-hmm. I feel like you definitely gained a lot of inspiration from classic Doom and Wolfenstein, and I will admit I vaguely remember those games, but I imagine they didn't hold your hand too much. Now, one interesting mechanic that you added for a Metroidvania, because every Metroidvania game, there's obviously a giant map to look at to help guide you, but you went an extra route to where the map disappears slowly unless you recharge it at a facility or laboratory to save the game and recharge the map. Where did that idea for a mechanic come from? How did you implement that in?
Yeah, it was a very divisive feature. Yeah, so at first I only had the map to be seen during the checkpoints. So I was thinking like, okay, players will have to like map their position to the map and then try to turn the corners around to see where they're going to end up. But then everyone was like getting stuck, and I was like, okay, I'll have to add a map that you can use at all times. But I'll make a compromise. You can't use it all the time. You need to use it sparingly. And that was where the drain map idea came. Because I really wanted people to just go look for the next checkpoint and not really be concerned like, oh, I have to go that way. Let me just turn the map on and just walk around without even soaking up on the walls and try to figure out where you are by yourself. So yeah, it's kind of me being stubborn, basically.
I think it added to the experience a lot more, because like you said, people just look at the map and look at where they need to go next. I'm victim of this, or I guess I'm a culprit of this, you could say, because I have every Metroidvania I play, I'm always looking at the map, looking at what item I need to get next. I did the same with Exophobia. I just ended up getting lost a few times because my map would die, and I'd just be like, okay, well, I don't know what to do next. But speaking of the collectibles and finding items, your game has a couple interesting ones. You have the CDs, which then you have the logs, which tell you lore of the game. You have the color filter. Yeah. But I want to talk about the color filter. Where did you get that idea? And was it hard to implement something like that? Being able to change your color of the entire game, really? What was that process like?
Yeah, so the color filter was born from someone just saying, like, when I tried to make the restrictive color palette with the reds and the blues, and I was like showcasing the game with Twitter posts and all that, and there was always like a comment saying, is this game only red and blue? And I was like, doesn't it get tiring? And I was like, I don't get tired of looking at it, but if people get tired of looking at it, then I'll add something that they can change. But again, a compromise, you have to find it in the game. And yeah, so it came from that, just people just saying that they could be tired of looking at it. So I had a bit of fun with it. So you can have like color filters that change to other colors, to other sets of colors, like red and green or something. But there are also some fun ones that change for like a Game Boy color filter or a Virtual Boy filter. But you really have to go out of your way to find it. I really want it to be something like the community-based thing. I didn't want like every player to be able to find it on their own, because I knew like the location of it will end up on the internet sometimes. So I just hid them they're very difficult to find compared to the logs and all the other stuff. But I wanted people to just say, oh, I found one here. It's in this location, and then put it on the internet, and you'll see like guides on the internet. I didn't want to be to give it all away to the player that easily. Unlike with the logs that you can find by getting the item that shows you in the map where they are.
Yeah, you have a lot of fun collectibles. And speaking of collectibles that are hard to find, there is one, well, two more technically. One of them gives you a secret boss ending, which I thought was fun. But before we talk about that, for some reason, there's dogs on every single floor. There's only four floors in the game, but what was with the dogs? Because those were incredibly hard to find. There's like no hints whatsoever of the dogs. I don't think there's like any like audio playback to give you a hint. But where did the dog inspiration come from? Just a fun little gimmick throw in?
Yeah, it's a fun little gimmick. Like I have this color palette that I like so much. I like doing pixel art, so why not like do pixel art of my dogs? And then I started doing them.
Are they all your dogs?
Yeah, one of them is mine. Then I have two from my girlfriend, and then another one from a friend. And then I had other friends asking me, "Hey, can you put my dog in there?" I was like, "I don't have more space." But maybe in a future update, I'll add more dogs.
Exo4U2 can have more dogs.
And it's basically like that. I made the sprites and I was like, yeah, what if they were in the game? So, and it worked really well because it's a Metroidvania and you're always looking for secret walls.
Oh, yeah.
So I think like a secret wall with a dog would like give you like, oh, a cute thing to find. And I had an achievement. If you find all four dogs, you get an achievement also. That was pretty much something that was like, yeah, just to fill up the map a bit more. The same with the helmets on the third floor. I don't know if you found any of those, but like in some secret areas, you can find like secret characters from other games.
I didn't see those ones. Okay. I did find the dev room with the shrine to the devs and all of that. But I didn't find anything else besides the gems, the dev room, the dogs, and all the other collectibles with the filters and whatnot, which was really good. But now I can ask you one thing I've seen on Twitter is Exophobia does have a physical copy. And I wanted to ask, what was the process of making a physical copy for the game? Or was that just something you let your publisher do?
Yeah, it's just something that I let my publisher do. Like I never thought of being published by a publisher. I was just like doing this game like just for me, like trying to get a commercial game out there. I thought like, oh, well, maybe I'll spend 1 to 2 years on this. It ended up being 5 years. But in the first year, I was like showcasing the game on Twitter and all that, and they contacted me and they said,
they reached out to you as well.
Yeah,
it's always nice to hear the publishers reaching out.
Yeah, at the time it was very, not I will not say that it was more common to. Yeah, it was a bit more common to do that in 2020, because it was like the boom of games and all that. I think.
Yeah.
Publishers were really looking for games to sign. Nowadays it's a bit different. You really have to approach them with a really good plan. But at the time I was like surprised that they wanted to invest in the game, and yeah, that's cool. And of course, like a dream to a game dev to have like the physical copy of his own game. It's really nice, and I got they gave me like a bunch of them so I can keep and give it to my team and all that, which is really nice. So the process is all theirs. It's PM Studios. They work with a lot of other devs to just publish games and physically and sell them at retail. And yeah, it's a really incredible experience for my first game.
I imagine your first major game, you get to see it in a physical copy growing up with Game Boy and all that. So probably a surreal feeling. Now we can go back to the development team for a second. I've noticed in the game, the game jams, back to those, and the music in Exophobia, did the music artist stay the same through all of your game jams and for Exophobia? I'm blanking on their name.
João Costa. Pedro J. Costa is how he signed the soundtrack. So that Do you remember when I said like the game jams, I would go to like a school or something and then we would make teams on the spot?
Yeah.
So I met this guy at one of those game jams. And then it was like there were a few people that worked on audio in those game jams. So he was one of the ones that were very requested, you know, like everyone had the programmers and artists, but no one had an audio guy. So he was the audio guy for all the teams sometimes.
All the teams, oh my God. Games. He probably had a lot of busier weekends than all of you.
Yeah, so all he did was like make the music for all the games. And then when a game won the best game, it was like, yeah, he was there because he was in every team. So yeah, it was nice. I met him there and then we became really good friends and just working together on all these game jams. And when I started this game, it was like, yeah, I want to work with you. I want to go into this project with you. And yeah, the result is really amazing because he's a really great artist, composer. And he did all this. I think it adds a lot to Exophobia, the way the music is like that, like the electronic music and all that.
Oh, yeah.
It really adds a lot to the
atmosphere of that game. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Now, for development of Exophobia, how big of a team are we talking? Is it just like five people with the dev room? Like, what's a budget for a game like this?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the dev room is me. And then there's that Pedro, the composer, and then Miguel, which is he did the sound effects. So it's three people, but it's mostly me full time and two freelancers. So they worked in a freelance regime. They had their own full time jobs, but they also worked it in the game. There's also an extra shrine, like you said, to a friend of mine that passed away, which is like my way of honoring him for. In the game, like he really wanted to see the game come to completion, but he passed away before that, which is, so I wanted to honor him in the dev room for that.
That's a very sweet way to honor him. He would probably love that game, then. It's so good.
I even also had a line for him in the credits. Like if it's a bit of my life work, and I wanted to like show that is there, right?
So
for the team, it's basically me and two freelancers. It's not usual like that. I usually have like more people, but I basically like to work alone. I don't know if it's but I really like to do the code and art at the same time when I'm working. Like I'm not a brilliant programmer nor a brilliant artist, but if I do the both at the same time, I think it becomes something cohesive, and you can see that in the way the game is presented, that it's something like only a solo dev can make, even if it's not the most polished thing or the most brilliant thing, but it can. I think solo made games have another taste to it.
I mean you made the game very well.
I like the word.
You did it really well for just basically being you. But how about any regrets in the process of the game being made? Anything you wish you did different there?
Yeah, maybe I think I tried to get too far, like to try new things. Like when you go to a professional project like this, like something that you want to sell, I had this idea like, oh, okay, I can finish this in 2 years. But the truth was that I didn't know a lot of the things that I was working on. I never did a 3D game before. I never did a Metroidvania before. I never like published on Steam before. There were a lot of unknowns. And I would say like, maybe I should have prepared myself better and do a shorter game like for myself first and learn these things first. But the game kept growing and growing, and then it became like this thing with the polish and all. Like now I have to make like a serious game that can be on a physical cartridge and all that.
Yeah.
So the game grew out to be something like that, and like I'm really proud of what I achieved, but maybe the result could be different if I had more experience in the matter. But now I can say that I have a lot of experience doing these things.
Yeah.
But it
It like, gave you a lot.
Yeah, it's like getting thrown in the sharks, right? Now you have to you have to do this. Now you have to figure out how to do it.
You adapt to the situation.
Yes. Yeah.
I guess I could ask this now that you mentioned it a little bit with the publisher. Did having a publisher sign you on, I guess, pretty early on in the project, did that add a lot of pressure on yourself since it was basically a one-man project?
Yeah, a bit. But at the moment, I thought I could do it. You know, like it's like that effect that the more you know, the more pressure you have. Because at the time, I didn't know that it would be that hard to do. So I was like, I had a lot of confidence, like, yeah, I can do this. It's easy. I made games before, even if they were game jams or really small things. But I can do this. But then as the time grew by, like that pressure really started to creep in. Other than that, it always felt like not a bad thing, you know, like because it's given me some hope to have like that backup from the publisher, like being helping out and working with me. Like they took me to some physical events like PAX in the United States. Like I'm from Portugal and they flew me in to the United States just to be in these two events, which really showed like a lot of belief in me, like that I can do it and that I can showcase my game and that I deserve to be in a place like that. So it really felt really humbling and and motivating to just keep going, having that backup.
So they flew you in. Did they fly you into PAX East in this past year, or PAX did they fly you into?
They flew. I was in PAX West and PAX East, but it was in 2023 and 2022, I think. Yeah, oh, West 2022. Yeah.
I was at PAX this past year for PAX East. It would have been great to see Exophobia. That I swear I would have remembered seeing that because I was all over the floor, but. Nice. Any other gaming conventions you've gone to besides PAX and do you feel like gaming conventions can be a big boost to an indie game, or is it kind of more of an investment, you could say?
That's a tricky question because like it's good for you, like if you never showcase the game and you like want to see players' reactions and all that in real time, just looking at the players, it's good. You really definitely should do it. But in terms of investment, I think the only investment is pretty much that, like that testing that you can get, seeing someone play in front of you. Other than that, like big conventions aren't that worth it for indies, because they're on. I think there are a lot of games in conventions, and the people that came by are can be few. But the best thing you can take is like the online events. Like I went to Gamescom this year also, last month. And it was nice like to see the people play and all that. Even I just wanted to get the experience of going to a convention with a game launched, because it's different to have before when a game is not launched yet. You have to get a wish list and all that. But now I was like, I'm showcasing the game, but the game is ready to buy. So I'm just saying, everyone, you can buy it, you can buy it, you can buy it. So it's a different feel, but if you have a coming soon game, I think the best thing you can take from these events is the online
fairs, like on Steam. Way to go!
Yeah, because they give you the visibility that you need for your Steam page and to get together a wish list. So that's really important for a coming soon game. So yeah, if you want to experience the physical thing of seeing what's the reaction on people's faces, it's really nice. Like I really enjoy it. But for an investment standpoint, like the numbers and all that, what's worth it is the online visibility. That's the where you get all the all the numbers.
Now, I remember when Gamescom was happening, a lot of great games were shown, but there was a thread going around on Twitter saying a Gamescom trailer costs like $100,000. Now, I don't have any of that insider information. I'm just a guy. But maybe, do you think that's true that those trailers cost $100,000?
What? That's a trend I didn't jump on. I should have done that. But from what I see, like, I think like, maybe the big ones, like the opening night live one,
yeah,
maybe
it can
cost something
as
like
well.
That.
Because I was like, there's no way those indie showcases are charging that much, because you don't got a budget for $100,000.
No, I think it's just really the AAA ones, the ones that you see on Opening Night Live and all that, and Game Awards. Those can cost something like that, yes. But yeah, indie games just try to do what they know how to do, right? The we're the cool kids and we don't need that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
it's nice. Yeah.
All right, now we can go back to the development and I guess marketing. How hard, because Exophobia, it's a Metroidvania boomer shooter, you could say, with classic pixel graphics. How hard was it to grab like the two different niches of Metroidvania fans and boomer shooters to try to convert them to a game like this? Because Metroidvania fans, there's not many FPS Metroidvania games out there, and boomer shooters, they're their own different thing, I guess.
Yeah, so yeah, you touched a really good point, because that's something I'm struggling with right now. Because it's really hard to sell the game to two different kinds of audiences, right? I thought they could mix well. Like when I designed the game, I thought, oh, it makes a perfect sense. Like in boomer shooters, you can find secrets. In Metroidvanias, you can find secrets. So it all works well together. You have keys in Doom. You can also have like gated keys in Metroidvanias and all that. It all mixes so well. And it made sense in a design view kind of point. But to sell the games, it's a different story, because you have to like you show gameplay and people are like, oh, this is like Wolfenstein. And yeah, but it has something more to it, and the exploration part is not really, it's really hard to convey, and the other way around, like the Metroidvania audience is going to look at it and say, oh, it is more focused on combat, or it's not as deep. The Metroidvania aspect is not as deep. Like something I've seen on Reddit, someone say that, oh, this, I played the Exophobia and it's very linear from a Metroidvania standpoint. And yeah, because
I disagree with that one.
Yeah, but I saw a lot of comments like that, and it's really hard to please both audiences at the same time. Yeah, and from a marketing standpoint, it's even harder to show that it can be enjoyable by both. Yeah,
because I've played a handful of Metroidvanias, tons of them, and I've also played a good amount of boomer shooters. I feel like it does definitely mix it well. I would say it does lean a little more on the boomer shooter side, but it's still, I got lost every like 2 hours. I was lost and like, okay, where do I go next? Well, I need to get to this elevator all the way across, so I need to go up this one. And then it was a jumbled mess, but in the best way possible, because in a Metroidvania, you want to be lost a little bit. It's not fun if you're just going right to the end of the game, just like that. So I guess, man.
Yeah, I agree. it's really hard to.
It's hard to market to something
that,
like
that. That feeling, yeah.
I guess I can ask, what is something you feel like, that, obviously the marketing is something that will be an answer to this, but like a common misconception to indie game development that people like me, for instance, who doesn't make games, I just play the games, what's something that we may not understand or expect?
Oh, sorry, can you repeat?
Oh yeah, what is something...
I think like, I got the question.
What's a common misconception in indie game development for people like me that we wouldn't expect or understand, really?
Oh, yeah, that's a hard one.
Yeah.
Yeah, like games, I think games take really long to make. That's something that like maybe the general audience doesn't understand. Maybe, I think like someone like you who plays a lot of indie games maybe knows that. Yeah, that's the case. Games take a really long time to make. I don't know what kind of other misconceptions there can be.
maybe people assume that every game has like a team of 10 people, has testers for everything, localization, all that.
Yeah, that's true. Like I suffered a bit with that, because that's something of that I not regret, but I think I should have done more Q&A testing, like really small things that went on when the game launched that it shouldn't have launched with those. If more people had played it, those bugs I could have found them earlier. But yeah, that's kind of hard, because indies nowadays, they can be anything, right? Like a team of 30 people to a team of just one. So it kind of blurs the line, like what is indie or not. And then you kind of assume that oh, if this game is considered indie and is as a team of 30 people, then this small other game should have like the same thing as that other big game, which is not the case in most times. I didn't have access to a lot of QA, for instance. I didn't have a big budget to like. I couldn't say like I'm lucky because my publisher could afford the localization and the porting to consoles and all that. And there's no complaining for me on that part. But for other kinds of games, like they can also explode without having that kind of access to those things. So every indie is different. Like we say indie, but it's a really big bag of everything.
There's a lot of different stages of indie. I see a lot of people. It's like the III showcase that happened back in like April. There's like the III indie games, you know, the Hades, the Hollow Knights, even though Hollow Knights is like three people, I think they just
three have, people, yeah.
Yeah, but like the teams that have grown exponentially, but they're still technically indie, like Supergiant, Red Hook, all that type of stuff. And then there's, you know, the tiny indie teams like yourself, where you have a lot more on your plate compared to those giant teams. Obviously, all the work is still a lot, but you have a lot of work on your plate.
Yeah, but that's just me being stubborn and trying to make a game on my own.
You did a good job for making a game basically on your own. And I guess I could ask, now that Exophobia is done, are you still looking for bugs to update Exophobia, or are you thinking of your next major project?
Yeah, I'm still looking at the Steam forums to find, like, sometimes there's bug reports and all that. But I think I'm reaching a stage where pretty much everything that can crash the game or be like a negative experience is almost fixed. So I think I'm going to be done with it soon. For next project, I don't know. I'm still in the mourning phase of like I let my baby go now. I'm
a little, like a bit lost. You got to take a little now? Bit of time before you're ready for another baby.
Yeah, but it's kind of weird because when I see other developers, like they launch a game and like a week after they're already doing prototypes for the next one, I'm like, how can you do that?
They
just need a vacation.
One game after another.
But it kind of has to be like that in order for indies to survive, unfortunately. Even if like, because your indie game will probably not sell enough for you to be like, oh, okay, I can take a vacation now.
Yeah, you got to like, go to the next case. Project.
Yeah, but yeah, so you kind of have to do that. But for me, like, I'm still trying to get my head together and see if really think about what can be the next thing. Probably not. This is me saying, but it can change. But probably not a project as big as Exophobia this time. Like something really small.
Don't want to tackle another Metroidvania.
Yeah, no, never again. I'm kidding. Like I really like doing it, but it's really a lot of hard work. And I think the genre is a bit saturated.
That is a nowadays. Good point, because I was talking to the Biogun developers in a recent episode, and they were also saying how saturated Metroidvania is. I actually watched a video saying Metroidvania is doomed, but there has been a lot of fantastic Metroidvanias released this year, and you were released right in the middle of all of them with Bo Path of the Teal Lotus, Gestalt's Demon Cinder, Biogun, obviously Exophobia, Nine Souls, Animal Well, the list goes on. Any of your what do you think about the saturation of Metroidvanias?
I think they're great. Like I'm friends with the game designer from Constance. I don't know if you
heard of the game. Constance. I've seen that one. That's been on the wish list for a bit.
Yeah, and the game exploded. It's getting a lot of attention, and it's nice. Like even if it's saturated, there are some really polished games that are standing out. And like the examples that you gave, I think they're all very successful. So even if they're saturation, I think there's a lot of people looking to try those games and all of them. Yeah.
Saturation in the best way possible.
So yes.
I can ask you
if it's good quality and they all have these different teams. So it's nice.
Yeah. What's been your favorite game this year? If you've been able to play some games after making your own, what's been one of your favorites? I want to hear it.
But from this year, that released this year?
Yeah, it could be this year, past few years.
Okay. Like, oh, I can say like the obvious thing, which is Balatro.
Balatro, top roguelite of the year, most definitely. Everyone loves that one.
Yeah, I think it was like the only game I bought it on launch day because I was like so addicted to the demo that I really wanted more. And then I was like, oh, it launched. I'm going to buy it right away.
Balatro is a
top. I don't usually do that. I usually just wait for a sale or something or play it on Game Pass, which is really nice because Game Pass has a lot of different indies. And I really like to play different genres of games, and it's really nice to try them out there. And if I really like it, I'll buy it. But yeah, it's really good. Like I played like another Crab's Treasure, for instance.
Oh, that's another great game.
Which is my first,
First Souls. Which is my
first Souls like.
Oh yeah. My first Souls like was Elden Ring a couple years ago. That was a disaster, I'll say. But you bring up.
Is it normal to die that much?
Yes, most definitely. I died like, over 1,000 times in my first Elden Ring playthrough.
I was like, am I doing something wrong? No, like, should I die like 20 times to this first boss fight?
If you were dying, you were doing something wrong.
Okay.
But you brought up Game Pass. That actually gives me one more question. Did you think about putting Exophobia on Game Pass? Or what's the process for that like?
Yeah, so that's kind of stuff like. It's
is that
kind
publisher
of
stuff as well?
That, yeah, publisher stuff. So
no, those publishers they do a lot. Like,
yes, yeah. So yeah, if you're a developer and you don't want to care about all the stuff, just get a publisher, right? Because you'll be writing a lot of emails and handling all this stuff. Yeah, but for Game Pass, I don't know the process, but actually my publisher asked me if they get a deal, if I wanted to take the deal. And yeah, I said yes. I think it would be cool to have the game on Game Pass. I think it's also really good for visibility, but I'm not really sure what the numbers are. Like, I think you get paid something to have the game there, and then it has to make sense from a predictability kind of like how many copies do you think you will sell, and if that number covers it or something. But yeah, from a developer standpoint, like just getting the game there would be like a nice thing. Like, but I didn't have the opportunity just to. They didn't offer me the chance to do that, but it would be nice.
That would be nice. I love looking at Game Pass. And I guess I have one more question for you before I let you go. And it's, do you have any questions for me, the gamer?
Oh, oh, that's a hard one. like, I saw you first heard that you were with the game, so that it kind of sting me a little. Especially the post game thing. But you're trying to do all the achievements, like, right?
Yeah, I was at some point. There's some hard ones in there.
Okay, maybe something like that. Like how do you view achievements, like those kind of Steam achievements or console achievements? Are they important to you? Do you go after all of them, or just for games that you really like?
For games that I really like, I will tend to go for all of them, but sometimes, since I have a limited amount of time, there are some achievements in a game that will just make me not be able to do it. I will say Exophobia has a couple that make me go like, oh my god. So it might be one of those games I have to settle for like 80% or something, but
yeah,
achievements like not dying the entire time, which I don't think you have. You have maybe Boss Rush not dying at all, which that's fine. I can easily do that. But achievements that make me replay the game multiple times in such an awful way, as in don't take any damage. Like that's always a common achievement in like those Vampire Survivor style games, but I'm not a big fan of those ones.
Okay. Yeah, I added some of those because it's just like if you replay the game and you get familiar with everything, it kind of becomes easier to do them.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, I know what you're saying. Like the kind of achievements that if you fail once, like you lose like 5 hours of playtime and you have to repeat it all again. That's something that I also dislike. Yeah.
All right. Is that the only question for the gamer?
that's a hard one.
I put you on the spot.
You should have prepared me for that. Yeah. Do you usually review the games that you play? Like, of course, you're a YouTuber streamer, but do you usually like write reviews for the Steam games that you buy?
In my world, since I make the videos and all that, I want to make a review on every single game possible, whether it be a YouTube short or a long form video, or I just want to somehow include every game that I can, like Exophobia, for an example. Mm-hmm. I want to include that in like a top 10 Metroidvanias that I've played in the year type of thing. So personally, it is one of the best ones I've played. Most unique one, definitely. I definitely want to make every game into a video, but sadly with how many games come out, it's hard to find the time for them all, you know?
Yeah, I was mostly referring to like the Steam reviews, the one that you write.
Oh, those Steam reviews. Oh, yeah, Steam reviews. I've been bad at those, but I'm trying to make sure and go back to write reviews on a lot of games that I've played because I'm trying to get better at it. Because I'm now doing these interviews, I'm starting to understand how valuable Steam reviews actually are, along with like wishlisted and telling people to buy the game. I'm trying my best to actually sell these games to everyone possible since I've started doing these interviews. So the answer is it's a work in progress.
Yeah, but that's really nice of you to like do that work to show how much you like the games that you play. Like, I've seen a lot of YouTubers just they do a review and then just post the link in the Steam review.
I've done
like
that
they
a
do a
times.
Video review and then post the
I've done that a couple times, but I still like I write down everything that I liked about it, and then I'm like, hey, if you want to watch a video, you can. But I just told you basically everything already, so
it's not just clickbait. Like
clickbait. I usually don't do that anymore now. Like I wrote a review for Crypt Custodian, and I made a video on it because I had the time, but I didn't tell the review, go watch my video, please. If a video does well, it does well. If it doesn't.
Nice.
Well, is that all the questions for the gamer? It's okay if you don't got any more. I threw it on you out of the spot. I decided to.
Yeah, it's okay.
A friend gave me an idea to have the developers ask me a question, and I was like, "Oh, I like that idea."
No, that's great stuff. Did you do it in the other episode? Because I was listening to it and I didn't get to the end.
So this was the first one. You were my first one. Okay. You were the first one to ask me questions.
Yes. I think I'm gonna let the other devs ask you more stuff.
I'm sure other devs will have a lot more questions, but that's those are all the questions that I had. So I greatly appreciate you taking some time and coming on. And if you got anything you want to sell to the people, you can just say it right now.
All right. So Exophobia is out now on Steam, PlayStation 4 and 5, and Xbox and Nintendo Switch. So if you wanna give it a try. You can buy it there. And please leave a review if you do. And thank you for inviting me. And thank you for playing the game. And yeah, it's been really nice to see your support, which is really great since it's been really hard for like an indie dev to get the game out there. And it's my first time doing it. So I've been facing like trying to get the game picked up by YouTubers and streamers. It's been hard. So I really thank you for giving your time to do it. And yeah.
Thanks.
And everyone else, please buy the game and wishlist it.
Yeah, buy the goddamn game.
There's a sale comes.
There'll be a sale
coming soon also.
There'll be a sale soon. Buy Exophobia. Genuinely, it's a great game. Great game. I'll sell it to everybody. Thank you again, Zark, for coming on. And we'll see you next time on the next episode of Interview in Indies. This is the first time we had that outro. Goodbye, everyone.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Interview in Indies. If you want to support the show and get the episodes a few days early, Patreon is the way to go there. And if you're a developer and you want to get on this show, hit me up on Twitter or just email me. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.